Session number 7390, reel 3.
They were the kings of, or they surveyed the higher up Ethiopia.
Colonel Gray, reel 3. What about Haile Selassie? Have you got any memories of him as a person?
I have a lot of memories of him. I think he was a wonderful little man. Very gracious indeed. And there is no doubt about it that I think he was the only one in that country who could have been the leader of the Ethiopians. He was a wonderful man, very gracious indeed, and had a very, very soft spot for the British, by the way.
What made you think that?
I think he told us so. And I have some photos, which I will show you later, of him visiting us. And I stayed on there to raise a signal corps for him afterwards, and I stayed until 1947. And so I did see an awful lot of him and went to his receptions and et cetera, like that, banquets and things. And he visited my signal corps quite frequently. And he was very, very interested in all that we were doing. I don't know if I told you, but after the capture of final surrender of the Italians, there was a British military mission to Ethiopia formed, which we just carried on. And we then started to form an army for Haile Selassie, for Emperor Haile Selassie, which finished up with, I think it was 10 battalions, with all the ancillary troops, like signals, engineers, gunners, RASC, etc., service corps. And he was very, very interested in what we were doing. I think the only snag was that we didn't, after the war, of course, Britain as such, didn't have the money to supply all the things that he wanted. And the Americans then came in and took over from us in 47, I think, 47, 48, 1947, 48. And, of course, they splashed the money about and gave him the equipment. But I went back there in 1966 because he invited us to the 21st anniversary of his return to Addis Ababa. And we were given a very great reception of the British people there, who returned there. And he was very, very kind indeed to us all. And very, he said quite openly that he was very pleased to see us back in his country.
Did the collapse of the Ethiopian regime in the 70s take you by surprise?
Very much indeed, yes. Although they were always having wars of sorts there, but rather on a minor degree, because each sort of portion of Ethiopia had its local king, or ras, as they call them. And they used to have to pay their taxes and tithes back to Addis Ababa. And when anyone of them were in default, Emperor Haile Selassie had to send out and shake them up a little. So there was always something going on. And out at Tigray, there was always a fight there because they did not like the regime at Addis Ababa.
What about the attitude of the Ethiopians towards the Italians?
In general, the high-class Ethiopians hated them. And an awful lot of them disappeared, the high-ranking Ethiopians. But
How do you mean disappeared?
Well, where they went to, one doesn't know. This is what I've been told, of course, when the Italians took over the country after the 35 war. Whether they went out... Well, we know that some of them went out in the country because a lot came to England. We met some of them Egypt and Sudan when we went back. In fact, two of my operators finished up, one as the commander of the Ethiopian army, and the other one as the head of the posts and telegraphs of Ethiopia. So they were very high-class Ethiopians. But we had picked them up in various places, Khartoum, Cairo, Gadarif. On our way in, they had heard that we were going in. But getting back to the way the Ethiopians... They didn't like the Italians. And... well, they wanted to live their own lives, which was very, very simple life, the Ethiopian life. And if they can only get enough food by tilling the land, that is all they were interested in, and had sufficient cows to get married with or to get their sons or daughters married off.
Well, why did they dislike the Italians so much?
Well, because they didn't like them in their country to start off with, and... well, I don't think any country likes being taken over and captured by another nation.
What did the ordinary Ethiopians, as opposed to the leading Ethiopians, think towards the Italians?
Well, I don't think they worried much about it. They didn't understand what was going on. And as long as they could live their ordinary lives and perhaps do a little work for the Italians, they were quite happy about it. They were not very well educated, the ordinary Italians. They were sort of 200 years behind the sort of standard of living of a Britisher sort of thing.
The Italians or the Ethiopians?
The Ethiopians.
And did the leading Ethiopians have much power over the ordinary Ethiopian?
Oh, yes. Life or death, almost. They were the kings of, or they surveyed the higher up Ethiopians. They were regarded in great awe by the ordinary peasant, who, as I say, was very, very poor indeed.
Did you see them exercise power over ordinary Ethiopians?
Well, I toured the country an awful lot because with my signal stations dotted all over Ethiopia. In the days when we were forming the army, I used to have to go around with my convoy and set up these signal stations and keep them working, sort of thing. Yes, I saw a lot of them, and they were a very simple, kind people, but culture, they were Christian, by the way. As I say, they were 200 or 300 years behind the times, and very frugal. Their main diets were injera and tulla or tej, which is what they drank, a form of beer from maize or wheat. And perhaps they'd have meat, which consisted of goat, about once a week. And that was about their diet.
Can you remember any of their customs which particularly impressed you?
They were very religious people. They used to wear a dress which was a sort of a blanket, a white-ish blanket, which they used to throw round them, which used to... go down to about half ankle length, and whenever they met you, they would always bow to you. And there was one word they used to say, world, countrywide, tenastilin. That was, how would you do, nice to meet you, sort of thing. Don't ask me how to spell that one.
Tenastilin.
Tenastilin.
What was the status of women in that society?
They were the carriers of water and wood and did all the cooking, raising the family, cleaning up as much as they did do. Very much behind. Very low standard of living.
Did the women seem to have any power at all?
None whatsoever. The men were dominant.
What was the attitude of the Ethiopians towards you and the other British who'd come?
Well, I would say they were very, very fond of us because I don't know what you know about the British when they get abroad, but they seem to get on with the natives, wherever it is. And we seem to get on with the Ethiopians very well indeed. Very rare indeed did we have any bad words with them. And I think they appreciated what we did for their country, very much indeed.
Were they able to communicate it to you?
Well, an awful lot of them spoke English. In fact, my whole regiment were taught English, you see, because, I mean, in signals, you have to signal in English. So, and I had 300 boys. I started off with boys and brought them all up and taught them English first. So, yes, my lot, and I will show you a photo of my signals officers, and every one of those could speak English.
Did they seem quick on the uptake or not?
Very intelligent. The upper strata of the Ethiopian is very intelligent indeed. That photo was of my signals officers, and they all signed it on the back when I went and gave it to me as I left. When I left in 1947.
How much of the actual fighting did you see?
Well, I was in most of it from the Sudan right up to Addis Ababa and then up to Ambalagi and the final battle at Gondar. I went through the whole lot.
And what were the Ethiopians like as fighters?
Bush fighters, excellent. And you couldn't expect them to fight against modern equipment, of course. They weren't used to that sort of thing. But for bush fighting, yes.
What, how were they with guns and equipment like that?
Well, they didn't like the heavy artillery, of course. They didn't like that at all because they didn't understand that very well. But give them a rifle, and that is all they wanted in life, really. Whenever you went out in the, right out in the country, any Ethiopian man that you saw had a rifle slung over his shoulder. Now, whether that was 100 years old or not, it didn't matter. He had his rifle and a few rounds of ammunition. That was the main thing in their life, was to have a gun. And, of course, an awful lot of them had to live by the gun, shooting animals or anything like that, to either to live or to keep animals away from their cattle.
Was there much law and order in the countryside?
Yes and no. There was what they called banda, which were thieves that went around in bands and raiding villages and stealing cattle and wives and things like that. But on the whole, no. Apart from these few bands that went round, no. They were very law-abiding.
Did you always feel safe in Ethiopia?
Yes. In fact, I can't think really why I managed to get out of it with my life, with the chances that we took. Because I often went all over the country for a month out into the blue and came back quite safe, whereas I think if it had been an Ethiopian convoy going around the country, they would have been shot off and looted.
But, you mean in Italian?
No, by the local banda.
You mean an Italian convoy? Or an Ethiopian.
The Ethiopian convoy, yes. If it had been an Ethiopian convoy going round, I think they would have been shot up, looted, and all the goods taken away. But touch wood, I managed to get away right the way in the five and a half years I was there without any scratches.
You said at Bury there was this slaughter. You mean it was indiscriminate?
No. It really was a very terrible battle, and there were an awful lot of deaths, true wounds, bullet wounds sort of thing. I call that slaughter on both sides. I mean, it was a heavy, really intense battle. Both sides lost heavily through bullet wounds.
You mentioned the Italian prisoner called Marcello. Did you take a lot of Italian prisoners?
I didn't see many myself. That was in the early days when we went in there and met our first local chief, who had been delegated to escort us into the country. And his men, 50, had captured him. I think they'd actually shot another and he died. But and then they took him round with them wherever they went. And he went along with us until Bourrier, when I think we then had to... All prisoners were then taken over by the British troops sort of thing and put into proper compounds and taken to Addis Ababa.
How was he treated?
Just as... well, he was tied up at night sort of thing, and he was given the same sort of food as they had. Reasonably. I mean, he wasn't ill-treated.
Was that typical of the treatment of Italian prisoners?
As far as I could see, yes.
Did they show any animosity towards him as an Italian?
No, I didn't see it, no. In fact, he was rather a prize. They were showing off to us.
Did you speak to him?
I don't think I did more than ask him a few questions when I first saw him. That was the last I saw. They just brought him up and presented him as their prize sort of thing and then took him away.
What did his demeanour seem to be?
I think he was accepting it. In fact, I think they gave him a woman to live with him, an Ethiopian woman to live with him as his wife. Well, that is another thing with Ethiopians here. Rather lax in morals. During the war, there was a law that you could take upon yourself a woman for the duration, and she went along with you as your wife if you had to leave yours behind, sort of thing. And at the end of the war, well, they split up, and so be it. That was it.
Did Mission 101 avail themselves of this facility?
We didn't, no. I think we had the opportunity. In fact, Fitorari Worku, he came to us. This was just after we'd got in there. And I remember it now. He came up to Brigadier Stanford and said, well, now, how many women would you like? Because I'm sure there's two young men over there would like one. And he was quite willing to bring the women, one each for us. But Brigadier Sanford said, no, that is not our type of life.
Was he offended?
No. Well, and Brigadier Sanford, knowing them, of course, said the right words.
Did you learn any of their language?
Very little, because, as I said earlier on, my regiment had to speak English. And they were all taught English.
Did you fall sick other than the exhaustion?
After that, no. In fact, my regiment, which was the Ethiopian Corps of Signals, I think we won most of the sporting trophies, and invariably I was in the team of cricket, football. They're great footballers. And I used to play for the senior team for them, which I think they... I think they rather took to me over that sort of thing as well. that I joined in with their pleasures and their games, as well as teaching them and turning them into a soldier.
But so your duties did leave you time for some leisure to play games?
Oh, after that war, yes. When we were forming the army, yes. Oh, we formed it as a British army, so that would be done.
Well, you mean playing sport after the war?
Yes, sport and things like that.
What type of equipment did you take in with you into Abyssinia? Did you take a lot of arms for them?
No, I think I said all we took in was three revolvers, two rifles, and about 10 old Ethiopian rifles. That was with the mission. But then, once we'd got the contact with the Ethiopians, we got the chiefs along and wrote out a letter for them to go back into... Yes, we've only got any minute now. To go back into Khartoum, Gedaref, where they would present this letter to the local governor there, and they would be given so many rifles, ammunition, etc., to bring back to foster the revolt, sort of thing. And I think I said they brought in about 20,000 rifles of sorts, which were given to them by the British to bring back to get the revolt going, which we distributed out to the various local chiefs and their armies.
Are there any particular incidents, perhaps, in the actual fighting that you'd like to describe?
Not really, because being signals, I was not in the firing line. I think the only one was when we were going in, during that 28-hour march that we had to do to get round the Italian headquarters at Dangola. It was about midnight, and something, we were going through a bush, very dense bush, and something came through the middle of us and broke the convoy. And I was bringing up the rear at that time, and I had to stop the convoy and try and find out what it was that had broken the convoy up, because the first half had already gone. But whether they were frightened of us, I don't know. But nothing further happened, and I eventually went on and joined up with the convoy and caught them up by the next morning.
What's your estimate of the Italian military performance?
I wouldn't say that it was they were very good. I think that the Ethiopians, once they started the revolt, had frightened them to such an extent that if they could have gone home then, they would have done. If they could have got out of the country. Their morale was very poor.
Did you see evidence of this?
Yes, they were quite willing to surrender, up with the hands, up with the white flags, whenever you got anywhere near them.
Would they surrender to the Ethiopians willingly?
They would rather do it if there was a white officer with them. I think, presumably there had been some atrocities in those years from 1935, and the Ethiopians hadn't forgotten, and neither had the Italians.
Did you ever see any atrocities?
No, I never saw any.
Were you glad to leave Ethiopia, or were you sad to go?
I was very sad indeed to go, but who was it? It was old Monty. He came and visited Addis Ababa in 47 and said, I remember him talking to General Cottam of the headquarters of the British military mission to Ethiopia there, and he said, well, the three or four of your officers have been here so long, it's about time they got back to the British Army. And within 6 months, I was back into the Royal Corps of Signals again, back in England, because I had been there for so long.